You know, the Virginia reel is good. That's folk culture. Those of you who organize the mosh pit, that's pop culture. Deconstructive, postmodern dancing. Now, you know, we talked about how this is an image-dominated culture today. There's a very funny thing along with that. Even though we're so image-centered, this is also an age of artistic illiteracy. Even though visual images are all around us, people know less about visual art than at any time before. Not only that, in education, again, the arts education is just nothing. I know when I was in school, the only art education I had, that we did finger painting, and we smeared, and the teacher said, "Oh, that's good, that's real good," and everybody seemed to get, "Oh, that's real good." I did a lot of collages, cutting things out of magazines, but that was the extent of it. I never learned to draw. Never learned anything to read a painting or to read a television show, for that matter. And again, we're in an age where people are illiterate or illiterate as far as reading. In a way, I think we're even in a worse shape because we don't understand art. We don't understand visual images either. Therefore, we just let them affect us and soak them in, and everything goes, and one is as good as another. Of course, in that void, because people don't understand anything about art, anything goes. Talk a little bit about the Karen Finley controversy. Karen Finley, she redid her work called The Return of the Chocolate Smeared Woman. And before she was getting funding from the National Endowment of the Arts for these kind of performances. And by the way, the high art culture today in this country is totally empty. They don't seem to know either what art is. There seem to be no standards, no aesthetic content there. And big vacuum, another opportunity for Christian artists to recover the art. But anyway, it's interesting though to read the editorials in the nation's newspapers, as I try to follow my work with World and other things. The editors would say, "Well, yes, this seems pretty silly, the woman taking off her clothes and smearing herself with chocolate, saying that's great art and deserves taxpayer funding." But then they would say, "But who are we to say what's art or not? Who are we to say what's good art?" And the editorials, over and over again, they would say, "Well, yes, now, I personally think that's pretty stupid. But again, I don't know anything about art. And art is always on the cutting edge. Art is always pushing us beyond," and so on. But even those educated people have very little concept about art, and they have no way of judging art or of evaluating what's good and what's bad. Now, we keep hearing about this conference. It's come up a lot. The classical, they were called absolutes. The postmodernists say there are no absolutes. But do you know what the absolutes are? We've kind of used them. I don't know if they've been termed as absolutes. And also probably we believe in the absolutes, but we don't know what they are. obviously there are a lot of things absolute, God and His Word. But in the old philosophy and theology, they would speak of the true, the good, and the beautiful. These three categories of reality that demand our attention and are essential to human life and the world that God created. True, of course, involves knowledge of what's real. The good, you know, moral truths, moral issues, and again, they have a category of absolutes. But in the beautiful, okay, this beauty was considered an absolute. Okay. And we've totally lost that. In postmodernism, of course, truth is relative, goodness is relative, and certainly beauty is relative. Very interesting, though, that Christians, we still say that truth is absolute. We still say morality, goodness is absolute, but all the Christians are willing to give in on the other. And we do say the beauty is absolute. Well, it doesn't matter. That's your taste, and you know, who's to say one thing better than another? Again, it seems to me that the loss of the other absolutes may have begun with the loss of beauty. In the sense that, well, you start to say that, well, art, you know, it doesn't matter. Whatever you like, that's fine for you. And then looking at things in that way became the same way people look at morality. Well, yes, you don't, you know, like abortion, that's all right for you, but other people like different things. So, you know, who's to say one's right and one's wrong? And then apply that same criterion to truth. Yes, I like that belief or I don't like that belief, and you know, that's your taste. In other words, even matters of truth, in other words, it become a matter of taste. And again, and I think to kind of rebuild these, we need to consider aesthetics and to recover the sense in which beauty is an absolute. So, you know, what even is art? Someone asked me, first to say what it is. We're not even sure what it is. Now, in the broad sense, in the classical sense, art was really any application of human creative powers. Okay. Any application of human creative powers. So that For the ancients, they didn't think of art just as, you know, paintings you put on a wall or music you listen to. They believed that every way of making a living involves an art. They believed that human beings make their living by a combination of nature and art. Okay, in other words, a farmer. They talked of the art of farming. Notice there's certain things, if any of you are farm families, there's a lot of things you have to know, a lot of skills go into raising a crop. And the idea that the farmer works with nature, which God provides, and then the human beings act on nature with their art and are able to raise a crop. The art of shoemaking. You have leather and the raw materials, and then you apply that art and you make shoes, something useful for everybody. Medicine, the art of medicine, the art of teaching. And I think that's a very profound insight that I think we should recover as Christians in our sense of vocation, in our sense of whatever it is you end up doing. The art of running a business, the art of raising a family. Again, these are creative things, gifts God gives to human beings, where we're able to do things to make things happen and to make something that's valuable. In education, the liberal arts. The trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, these are arts. The quadrivium, music, astronomy, science as an art, geometry, which included drawing, by the way, the knowledge of space, which that'll leave out, mathematics. These are arts?
Yeah, these are skills and abilities that you're learning. That's what an education is. You're learning art. I mean, you apply those skills, tools of learning, in so many different ways, in so many different kinds of content. Now, fine art is a category of these arts where human beings are using their human creative powers kind of for their own sake to make something that isn't useful in the way a shoe is or the way raising crops is. They're creating something for its own sake, creating for the purpose of the realm of beauty. Okay. So that's where we get the fine arts, painting, sculpture, music, poetry, literature. These are arts. Okay. Now, in considering art, let's see what the Bible says about art. Have your Bibles. Turn to Exodus chapter 35. If it made you look at the Bible in my class, what made you think that Lutherans don't use the Bible? Look at Exodus chapter 35, verse 30.
Turns out the Bible has an enormous amount of things to say about visual art.
Exodus 35, verse 30. Okay, this the setting. This is kind of looking back on Exodus 31. Moses has just received the commandments on the mountain. He's receiving the laws of sacrifice and other laws of worship. This is in the same context. And then God told Moses his provision for his calling of an artist. Actually, more than one artist. Okay, let's read it. Exodus 35, starting at verse 30, going to first verse of 36. Okay, then Moses said to the Israelites, this is after he's come down and he's telling the Israelites what God, and this is kind of repeated word for word as the other things from chapter 31. So, then Moses said to the Israelites, "See, the Lord has chosen Bezalel, son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God, with skill, ability, and knowledge in all kinds of crafts to make artistic designs for work in gold, silver, and bronze, to cut and set stones, to work in wood, and to engage in all kinds of artistic craftsmanship. And he has given both him and Oholiab, son of Ahisamach of the tribe of Dan, the ability to teach others. He has filled them with skill to do all kinds of work, with craftsmen, designers, embroiderers in blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and fine linen, and weavers, all of them master craftsmen and designers. So Bezalel, Aholiab, and every skilled person to whom the Lord has given skill and ability to know how to carry out all the work of constructing the sanctuary, or to do the work, just as the Lord has commanded." And of course, these artists went on to construct works of art, such as the Ark of the Covenant. Talk about a
beautiful gospel-bearing work of art. How imaging, you know that, the commandments in the box and the mercy seat and how the blood covers the broken law. Yeah, Christian art, the art of the tabernacle, which includes realistic art. Later, you see something similar in the temple. There are pictures of lions, and statues of lions, actually. Palm trees, pomegranates. Why palm trees and pomegranates? I guess because those are beautiful things. And anyway, the Bible goes on to detail in chapter after chapter of excruciating detail. How many cubits this is supposed to be? How did it? Apparently, God is interested in how things are made. He gives instructions on how to make things. You know, a lot of people start, well, I'm going to read the Bible straight through, and they go on, and then they get to the details of the tabernacle and kind of lose the thread. You know, to us, it's kind of tedious, perhaps, to read. But notice, God thinks it's important. People making things. Now, I want to look at this text in some detail. Because it specifies the gift God gives to artists. Now, it talks about how the Lord has chosen Bezalel. So the older translations, I think, even better. It says, I have called him by name. God calls Bezalel to the work. God is calling the artist to do this. Again, being an artist is a calling. Okay? It's a vocation. One of the most kind of touching things that came out, again, I've written about this in my book State of the Art, and an artist came to me, and I'm just so thankful for that book, because she had thought, she was very talented as an artist, and she had thought that, well, what she really needs to do is serve God. And so she suppressed her interest in her ability. She stopped doing it. She tried to get a job with Campus Crusade and, you know, was doing that, but she said she wasn't doing a very good job with that. And the realization, maybe if God has given her these abilities and these talents that not everybody has, that being an artist is her vocation. And that's not to be despised. The tragedy is that the church often very hard on its artists. There's no interest in what they're doing, thinks they should be doing something practical, and are suspicious of the crowds they run in. And it's a terrible thing, and it weakens the church not to have the artist as part of what the important cultural work that we have. But anyway, let's look. So, chosen Bezalel. Now, look at verse 31, this list of gifts that God gave to Bezalel to enable him to make these incredible things for his worship. He filled him with the Spirit of God. Bezalel is the first person in the Bible to be said to be filled with the Spirit of God, which means, among other things, he was a man of faith. Holy Spirit was in him. And of course, I think that's the first criteria for a Christian artist, at least, to have that grounding in faith, to have that Spirit of God. And look at the others. He has filled him with the Spirit of God. He has filled him with skill. And think of what it takes to be able to make a work of art, whether it's music or poetry or painting or weaving the cloth that Bezalel was involved in. It takes skill. Okay. Very important dimension of art. You probably see that there's some art, the passes for art, that really doesn't have any skill. I'm not sure what skill it takes to smear chocolate on yourself. I think most of us maybe could do that. Notice as we look at the Bible, for the art, some principles emerge that can help us in evaluating art. You know, how much skill did this take? Okay, so that's one gift. He has filled him with ability. Okay, ability is described as God's gift for an artist. Talent. Now, not everybody can play the piano. I took piano lessons in my day, but I did not have the talent to be a piano player. I learned a little bit, and it's kind of nice, but it just makes me appreciate more people can sit down at the piano and do great things with it. Not everybody can draw or use words. It's a talent. And where does the talent come from? Well, it's a gift of God. We need to honor the talent that God gives our artists and see where that comes from. Notice it's not just Bezalel. Later it talks about every person in whom God put ability. All of the Israelites who had talent in making art, they all got together to make the tabernacle. So, another gift for art, ability. And knowledge. Okay, knowledge. You need to have knowledge. You need to know some things to be an artist. You've got to know your material. You probably need to know something about the history of your form or what you're doing fits into it. You have to know about a lot of things. Bezalel had to know about the properties of his materials. You know, he had to know how to build something so it wouldn't tip over. There's a lot of practical knowledge. There's a lot of theological knowledge for Bezalel. And he had to know exactly how God wanted these things to be. Yeah, so art and the artist here, one of the gifts for art is knowledge. I think there's a lot of work that passes for art today that has no knowledge. Return to the chocolate smeared woman. I'm trying to think what we're supposed to learn from that. But that becomes a helpful criteria. And notice that the scope, skill, ability, knowledge, and all kinds of crafts. Just opening all of the different forms. It's interesting. He also gave him another gift, the ability to teach others. Bezalel also, he would go to the, cluses among the Israelites and teach them how to do some of these things. Maybe they weren't as gifted as he was, but this tells me that art can be taught. Okay, that maybe somebody who has talent, they maybe don't know they have talent. And that usually it's in the company of a teacher who brings this out of them and teaches them how to use it. And so, again, it seems to me that this is not just a one-time inspiration of Bezalel, necessarily. It seems to describe what it takes to be an artist and to say how God honors the artist, and how God is saying that the ability to do incredible work ultimately comes from Him. And I think even if an artist doesn't know God, the talent that artist has, assuming there is some, is from God. And we can honor that even while we, you know, pray for the artist's soul who doesn't know Christ. Well, we could go on. The Bible, there's so much about it. In my book, Say of the Arts, I go through really closely about all of the passages in the Bible that talk about art. Look at the different works of art described in the Bible. Look at where art can go wrong. That's important too. Notice while Moses was up here getting the Ten Commandments and hearing about the call of Bezalel, Aaron was down on the plain making a work of art. Right. He was making a work of art. Let's look at Exodus 32. Just briefly. Again, if you go to chapter 31, this is kind of repeats much of that passage I just looked at about God talking about. Well, look at 31. About the call of Bezalel. Then 32 is about the golden calf. And here, of course, art is being misused. Art is being used for idolatry, to lead people away from God. Art is being used for unlawful pleasures, the people just having an orgy around that golden calf. But what I want to draw your attention to is that Moses came down and confronted Aaron with this. I mean, he threw down the commandments with fire and earthquake. And then he said, Aaron, you're the priest. Why did you make a golden calf? No, it was Aaron that made the golden calf. In other words, it was somebody in the church. It was the church leader who made the golden calf. But look what Aaron says. Look at 32 verse 21. He said to Aaron, look at Moses in 20. Took the calf and burned it and ground it into powder, scattered it in the water and made the Israelites drink it. Boy, that's nice response. But he said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you led them into such great sin? He says, do not be angry, my Lord, Aaron answered. You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up, we don't know what has happened to him. So I told them, whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off. And they gave me the gold. I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. I had nothing to do with it. But notice how this ties into what we've been talking about in this conference. Why did he make the calf? Because he wanted to express his faith. Who was he responding to? To what the people wanted. Okay. To the market forces. Okay. The people wanted it, and so he filled that market niche. He didn't even like what he was doing. He wasn't even applying his own creative powers as an artist. He said, well, I just put it in and out it came. Well, okay, this is pop culture, right? Instead of being an artist with integrity, expressing his faith, which we know Aaron had, he surrendered to the desires, in this case the sinful desires of the people, and art becomes twisted from God's purpose. It's not a reason to throw art out because it can be misused. The key is to use it well. Well, again, there's a lot more we could say about what the Bible says about the arts. What I'd like to do is just give you a few aesthetic principles. A few things to help you look at a work of art, whether it's a painting or music or anything, and just a brief introduction on how to evaluate a work of art. It's kind of a crash course in aesthetics. There's a lot more, obviously, that that could be said I'm going to have time to get into, but this is an area for study that would be very, very profitable for you. Okay, let's consider two statements. Here are two things that people often say about a work of art, whether it's a movie or TV show or a, you know, impressionist painting or a record. What's the difference between these two statements? I like that. Okay, that's one kind of response. Or, this is good. I really like that record. This is a good record. Okay. I really like that painting. This is a good painting. Okay. Now think about that. When you say I like it, what are you describing? What are you telling us? About the work of art or about yourself? Okay, to say I like something is a description of you, right? Your taste, what you enjoy. Okay. If you say this is good, you're making an objective statement about whatever it is you're referring to. Okay. And I often hear people say, Bach, he's no good. Okay, that's I hate that kind of music. That's boring. Bach's no good. Well, again, what he means is I don't like it. Okay, for one reason or another, he doesn't respond to classical music. Well, that's okay. That's understandable. But that doesn't mean that Bach is not a great musician. Okay, to evaluate whether Bach is a great musician, to say this is good, obviously you need to know something about music, and you need to know something about the work, and you need to understand it. And you see that. Well, do you, understand that music? No. Even listen to much of it? No. I don't. But again, he doesn't like it. Yeah, that's okay. It's okay. But notice, keep straight the differences between those kinds of judgments. Can you like something that isn't good? Can you like something that's bad? Well, yeah. People like sex and violence and sin and golden calves and all the rest, or the human nature. Yeah. You can certainly like and enjoy when Karen Finley takes off her clothes. I'm sure many of the people in the audience like that a lot. Does that mean it was a good thing that she was doing? No, those are two different things. Can you not like something that's good? Yeah, I remember our kids, my daughter, and my wife would make a wonderful meal. And a really great, great dish. And my little girl, when she was little, would say, this isn't any good. What she meant was she doesn't like onions, and this dish had onions in it. That doesn't mean it wasn't a good dish. But there's something in it that she responded to very violently, and so she didn't like it, even though it was good. So yeah, we can like things that are bad, they're bad for us, or that are badly done, but that we get a kick out of it. And not always in a negative way. When my daughters, when they were little, would bring their little pictures of their little drawings and say, "Here, Daddy, I love that." I'm not saying the little pictures of the sun with a smiley face and a little house. I'm not saying that's great art. It doesn't have to be. But I love it. Okay. Again, notice the distinction between liking something and recognizing how good it is. I mean, I recognize the greatness of Henry James, the famous novelist. He's a great, great writer, a genius, but I don't like reading him. I don't like, to me, they're too tedious. They're dull, but they're very great. But again, I wouldn't say that he's a bad novelist because of my limitations or of my, because I don't, for one reason or another, like something. Again, there are a lot of reasons you could like something. I tell people, that was a good movie. That is a great movie. I'll hear students talking about that. And I'll say, oh, really? Texas Chainsaw Massacre, great movie. I said, well, okay, what was good about it? Was the acting really good? Well, no. Did they have a really profound story that really opened up the mysteries of life? Well, no. The plot is really kind of stupid. Was the cinematography, the photography and the camera work, is it really good in it? Well, no, not really. And, what was good about it?
Well, they got the chainsaw and they cut the guy in half and the guts came out.
In other words, they were enjoying maybe the special effects or the grossness of it. That can appeal to a certain childish level that may be in a lot of us, even adults. But that doesn't mean it's good.
Like it.
Of course, the pop aesthetic is only concerned with liking. Okay. Only concerned with that level. Now, again, I'm not saying that's totally a bad thing. But if it's the only thing, you're missing a lot. Growing in taste means learning to like what is good. In other words, learning to like subjectively what is good objectively. And growing in taste is the process of taking pleasure in what's good. And you'll find that the more you grow in that way, the more you learn to love what is good and to like it, the more pleasure you actually get. I suspect that someone who really knows music, and he's really set and learned to love Bach, is actually getting more pleasure out of listening to that piece of music than flipping on MTV and watching it for 30 seconds. The pleasure, I'm talking about pleasure, is more. Again, growing in taste. And I think we should grow in taste as we grow in other areas of our lives. The big problem with us baby boomers who created most of the problem that you guys are having to straighten out and causing you your problems too, I think. Baby boomers, we haven't grown in taste. You'll see people, 50 years old, turning to listening to the music that they listened to when they were adolescents. And again, that's not natural, not normal. Fine, yes, the Beatles, great, I love. But man, can't you change in your take? Can't you grow and beyond that? Well, anyway, that's one distinction you might try to make that kind of opens up and I think frees your response, because it is all right to like something without it being good. You may really like Precious Moment figurines because they're so sweet, and that's fine. I'm not taking that away from anybody. It doesn't necessarily mean they're great works of art, but again, maybe they don't have to be. But again, keep those distinctions in mind and learn to appreciate the really fine things. Okay, so I want to talk about the fine things and how to kind of help you with that a little bit. Another useful distinction to make is between form and content. Okay, the form and content. A work of art often is saying something. It is embodying a worldview or an idea or an attitude. That's the content, you know, what that it's communicating or expressing. Okay, that's the content. The form is the way the content is presented. Okay. Now, the form is where the artfulness of it comes in. The artist's use of color and paint, the visual artist, the writer's use of words, the musical design of a composition. That's the form. And the content, again, is what's being expressed. Okay, when you evaluate a work of art, I encourage you to judge both. First, you can look at them separately, and then look at them together. Okay, in other words, look at them separately. What is the content of the work? Now, you're learning a lot of this in our discussions of worldview. I hope you get to the point of where you can look at a work of art, whether it's a painting or a novel, or and pick up the worldview that's implicit in that. Now, then look, though, at its form. Now, notice those are two separate things. Maybe the content is something we disagree with. The worldview is all off. Can the form still be good, even though the content is bad? Because very often it is. You can look at an impressionist painting. When you say the worldview of impressionism, the view that looks at nature solely from a subjective point of view, solely as images on the retina of the eye, you can see that impressionism documents the kind of inward focus that would develop into the modern rejection of truth. You know, so you can criticize the worldview of an impressionist painting, and I hope you do, from a Christian perspective. Can you still find the paintings beautiful? Well, yeah. You look at an impressionist painting, Monet, and the colors and the light. It's beautiful. Even though the worldview may be faulty. Okay. And again, and it's possible to look at things like it, to critique the content while recognizing the talent and ability and the beauty of the work of art and thank God for the beauty that is possible. Okay. So very often you'll find yourself doing that. Again, I disagree totally with the worldview of Ernest Hemingway. He's a good writer. His novels are really well done, even though his worldview is totally askew. And so sometimes it helps as you're responding in an intelligent way or even dealing with some of these writers in a class or certainly in the college level. See, often we take the content and then just blow everything else away. Sometimes it's possible to appreciate the form. In fact, form, good form, beauty, and I think is just about, I can't think of an exception, it's going to be in the realm of godliness. In other words, human beings can't create something that's beautiful while, if it's beautiful, again, it's in our side. It's one of the absolutes. It's just like something that's true or good, beautiful. That's our side. We treasure that, even though the artist maybe isn't a Christian, but if they can create something beautiful, good. Sometimes the form is bad, but the content is good. Okay. Precious Moment figurines. They have a really nice message they're giving, and it's possible to accept that message and to like it and appreciate it and agree with it. You know, maybe that the form, that the artfulness of it isn't you know, great work, but we can appreciate it and use it and enjoy it for its content, even while recognizing that it's not, you know, an aesthetic masterpiece.
Okay. So again, sometimes it helps to look at both, you know, separately. You know, the words of the song or its content, the form of the music. Okay, that's an issue of form, as is probably the word choice. In other words, the song may have a really good idea and a good message behind it. Maybe the words don't make sense, or they're confusing or too sappy or something, even though we can, you know, agree with the content. Now, of course, ideally, the best works are, it's when the content is good and the form is good, you know, when those come together.
Now, by the way, form and content always do go together. And in fact, the form often really conditions the message. That's one thing to in judging art, in evaluating art. How well does the form embody the content? I saw a precious moment figurine of the crucifixion. Okay? The crucifixion. Now,
you know, you have these sweet little cute, but the crucifixion? I mean, the crucifixion, it wasn't sweet. You know, that was something.
And I would say that, although, you know, agreeing with the content and, you know, that's fine, not being too hard on it, but see, that the form does not match the content. And so the form maybe can actually detract from the content in many times. I could give you examples of that. I don't think I have time. The song Mac the Knife has a really pretty melody. The words are, the shark has pearly teeth, and his teeth are razor sharp. It talks about magic. This is written by Brecht, who is an experimental, who purposely wrote it so that the form would be opposite to the content. So there's a really pretty melody talking about shark and professional killers stabbing people, Mac the Knife. Again, it doesn't go together. And in this case, it was done on purpose. But a good work of art, the melody, for example, should help us convey the meaning, okay, and support the content. Sometimes it does that very effectively, and that's when the work of art is really going well. I mean, it's less effective. Let me say something about form, though, about judging form. By the way, when we talk about beauty, that doesn't mean it's necessarily pretty. That's another distinction. All the ancients thought that tragedy was the highest form of drama, the most moral form of drama. Now, tragedy, yeah, it's not, you know, isn't that nice and pretty? No. Art and beauty itself can involve sometimes painful things and yet aesthetically be very powerful, maybe even more powerful than something that's just kind of nice. But let me say some things about form, some kind of classic aesthetic categories to look for. I like Francis Schaeffer. Schaeffer talks about, when he talks about politics and governments and things, he talks about to have both order and freedom. You know, the genius of our country as it was founded is there's order and yet freedom. And they'll come together. This ordered freedom is really a very good aesthetic category. That's a good thing to look for in art. A sense of order, but also a sense of freedom. You listen to a work of Bach. There's order there. But there's also freedom. All the instruments are doing something different, and yet it all comes together into a whole. Yeah, that's great art.
even a painting, a sense of order and composition, and yet a sense of energy in the work. Those are the greatest, some informal qualities. Shakespeare, order, freedom. And watch for that. That's a good aesthetic category. Some work can be so ordered that it's dead, just mechanical.
A lot of modern art just blocks of color. They're arranged very nicely, and they're very ordered.
Well, okay, but there can be a kind of a deadness to work of art that's just pure order and so stiff. There can be art that's totally chaotic, totally wild. Yeah, abstract expressionist, drawing paint against a canvas on the wall, scattering it everywhere. Sense of chaos. Well, but it's missing order. Bring them together. Whether it's an impressionist painting or a great piece of music, you have both of those senses. Ruskin is a very helpful, the best Christian discussion of art by somebody nobody reads anymore, Ruskin, an English writer that wrote in the 1800s. He said that everything we find pleasing in art, the reason it's pleasing is because it has something to do with some quality of God. The Bible says the source of all beauty, or in ultimately the beauty of holiness, or in some moral truth. He relates that together. For example, the categories of unity and complexity. It's kind of a similar to order and what Schaeffer called order and freedom. Again, a sense of order, a sense of unity. It all comes together, and yet there's complexity. Stevie Ray Vaughan playing the blues. Doug Wilson, who was here last time, big Stevie, so he would be a good one to I can use him. Notice the blues are so structured. There's a very definite, 12 bars, a very specific chord progression out of the folk culture. And so he's following that. There's an order, there's a unity, and yet there's complexity. All the things he's doing with it as he's working in terms of that order. Yeah. And Ruskin says, well, because ultimately, God is a unity and complexity. Doctrine of the Trinity. God is one. God, three persons constituting a perfect unity. And again, so that quality, when we see it in a work of art, the combination of unity and complexity, it appeals to us. And there's a reason, because it's built into the fabric of existence as God's work of art, when he expressed himself in his creation. Balance and harmony. And the composition of a painting, the way the different elements are put together, that's the composition. And the aesthetic design that opens up. And also the harmony of colors. The way different colors go together. Or in music, even the wildest music is built on harmonies. The sounds to go together, different people singing different notes, and yet they blend. That's another aesthetic principle that we pick up on. Ruskin related that to harmony, related to love. Love is, separate individuals coming into harmony. That's what love is. Other things, he talks about infinity. There's a whole category of beauty called the sublime. The sublime is something that takes your breath away. The Grand Canyon. They're artists, Hudson River artists, something, but that's what their specialty was, these sublime landscapes. Just mountains, and it just opens up the space, just goes back forever, and at the back of the painting, it just swallowed up in light. They're trying to paint transcendence through nature, but then going beyond nature to the infinite, to God. And again, Ruskin said, the things that approach the infinite please us because God is infinite. The sense in the work of art that there's so much more there. There's so much there. The work of Shakespeare, you never come to the end of it. You can never figure out Hamlet completely because there's so much depth. And the more you look, the more it opens up. And again, that's a quality of great art. It seems almost inexhaustible. Difficulty. Ruskin said a very kind of easy rule of thumb is how difficult is this work to make?
Again, a painter where every detail is in place, and you have to be astonished. And again, the talent and ability that enable someone to do something so difficult. Conversely, something are so simple there isn't anything to them.
Well, learn to play the guitar, believe it or not, the scourge of pop culture. Play the guitar, and I appreciate a lot more of that. But you know, some of the songs that, like, wait a minute, that's only two chords. There's not much to that. And he's using a capo. You know, how great a piece of music can this be? And, again, which points out another point. The more you know about something, the more there is to enjoy. And again, just I'm out of time. Study aesthetic, study art, appreciate art. And again, the benefit of it is so almost selfish. The more you know about an art form or aesthetics, just like the more you know about sports, the more you enjoy a game. The more you know about music or painting or sculpture, the more of a pleasure and profit it opens up for you. So I hope as you're developing your thinking Christianly, your imagination Christianly, again, to look at the art Christianly. And for those of you who have that vocation, that those talents from God, use them for Him, because we've never needed that more. Thanks.